Nous revenons sur le grec avec Monsieur Petros Diatzentos, qui nous parlera des mythes fondateurs de la réforme et des affaires de prescription au XIXe siècle.
Great, thank you very much. So the aim of this paper is to explain how and why the founding myths about Greek language history are associated with a lack of willingness to prescribe the purest language in the 19th century. The starting point of this presentation is based upon two considerations. So I think that, okay. Okay, that's great. The first one is that throughout the 19th century, there was a lack of prescription of the purest language. More explicitly, there were no normative pieces of work, no grammars, no monolingual dictionaries, and no school manuals. Furthermore, from the independence of the Greek state until the mid-1880s, modern Greek was not even taught in schools. Meanwhile, very little state involvement was observed in language planning. Modern Greek language reform was engaged in a process that I will call archaization. This reform was mostly undertaken by scholars as well as non-institutional organizations. The second is the emergence and consolidation of founding myths about the history and the current state of language. As a matter of fact, the first metanarrative of Greek language history was constructed during the second half of the 19th century. My aim is to discuss whether there exists a relationship between these two phenomena. Should this be the case, then it is to define an interpretive framework within which this relationship can be explained. My point is that these two phenomena are closely connected. Indeed, the Greek language mythology did not encourage the achievement of a set of prescriptive rules, but on the contrary, nurtured an ideological context that stimulated the proliferation of norms, be they morphological, stylistic, or lexical. Before moving further on, it is necessary to come up with the definition and use of some terms. I work in a Macintosh. Okay, that's great. The purest language, also referred to as Katharevousa, is the common variety of a literate strata of society and covers the fields of written communication, press, civil services, literature, science. It is a written variety with a very heterogeneous morphosyntactic aspect all over the 19th century. Demotic is a literary language very close to the common spoken variety which came up in the urban centers during the same period. It dips both into the latter and into Greek vernaculars. Demotic became the basis of the standard modern Greek in the middle of the 20th century. Purest Greek, demotic, vernaculars, and the common variety of urban centers are the constitutive bricks of the 19th century modern Greek. The second half of the century was the period when modern Greek, either as a historical subject or as a synchronic phenomenon, attracted more and more scholars' attention. Appraisals, judgments, or conjectures on the history of language became more and more numerous. This set of views and assessments was shaped through a series of overlapping postulates summarized in the following 4 points. Just like that. Firstly, the Greek language unity, that is to say, the absence of any separation between ancient and modern Greek. These are not considered as two separate entities. As a consequence, ancient Greek is seen as a living language, and what is commonly called modern Greek, purist or vernacular, is only considered to be the latest stage of ancient Greek. The conservative character of language. That means that Greek, unlike other languages, evolves very slowly. The pace of language shift is attributed to a set of inherent and timeless qualities in relation with its very nature, the so-called genius of the language. the Greek language singularity, which means that this language stands as a special case in the linguistic history. That is how comparison with the history of other European languages and civilizations becomes important for the Greek scholars. In fact, the specificity of Greek language consists on its interesting qualities, its unique place in the history of languages, and its special role in the history of the universal civilization. At the present time, it is the language which, through its nature and its historical trajectory, is bound to accomplish a great mission. And for a highly ancient genealogy of modern vernaculars. From the middle of the 19th century onwards, we witness the rehabilitation of modern Greek dialects and the assertion of their Hellenic origins. Several works of self-taught or amateur scholars trace them back to the Homeric language and even to missing or hypothetical languages. Yet, overshadowing the Hellenistic origins of vernaculars eventually awarded them a high antiquity certificate in some way superior to that of classical Greek. According to the prevailing view, ancient dialects evolved in parallel with the Koine, regarded as the actual ancestor of Katharevousa. Modern Greek vernaculars, seen in the past as semi-barbaric and degenerate, henceforth stood alongside Katharevousa and provided evidence of a language unity and an unbroken continuity of ancient Greek. As we will show later on, the rehabilitation of vernaculars met the need of redesigning the identity of the rural masses. The founding myths and the gradual construction of the first language history metanarrative came as a result of the specific political situation in the 1850s. They were related to concrete political issues and were embedded in the national ideology. More specifically, they were part of a discourse that aimed at legitimizing a set of political, cultural, and linguistic targets. These founding myths shaped a mental framework inside which goals and means of reform were clearly set out. Actually, this is the context within which the lack of determination to prescribe the purest language and produce normative works has to be observed. The Crimean War marked the Greek sociopolitical context of the second half of the 19th century. And this conflict, which pitted Russia against the Ottoman Empire and its French and British allies, Greece sided with Russia, thus hoping to take advantage of the war so as to annex the territories of Thessaly and Epirus. However, the Greek expectations were quickly disproven, and the elites realized that no territorial expansion could be expected from an armed conflict. Moreover, from 1850 on, new Balkan nationalisms emerged and competed against Greek territory claims. At that time, Greek nationalism sought ideological endorsement against the Bulgarian claims, then supported by the Russian Empire. With the war ending, national goals and the means to reach them were redirected, and modern Greek language reform turned out to be a major challenge in the national construction process. After this major event, arose a cultural project which identified the language reform as an essential tool towards the achievement of national goals. Since these goals could not be attained through military actions, the spread of the Greek language and literature, along with the assimilation of Balkan populations and a cultural conquest of them, became the new strategic target. This civilizing mission of Hellenism was to be shaped throughout those years. One of the necessary conditions for achieving this target was to approach the ancient Greek language by the archaization of Katharevousa. The civilizing mission of Hellenism, whose vehicle would be ancient language and literature, soon met the necessary ideological endorsement. The Greek historiography of the second half of the century provided the first one by consolidating a narrative of language history widely aligned with national expectations. For Paparigopoulos, the founder of national historiography, Greek language is the witness of the survival of our civilization throughout the millennia, as well as the immutable law of national history. According to him, only through language we will be able to fulfill our future civilization task. This language, which was no other than ancient Greek, became a major identity indicator and played a most important part in the national project realization. Denying the survival of ancient Greek was equivalent to denying both the ancient origins of modern Greeks and the historical continuity of the nation. Considering ancient Greek as a dead language, like Latin, could seriously impact both the interpretation of the national continuity and the legitimacy of the Greek nationalism political goals. Roman language's evolution involved a vision of political history with a specific meaning among Greek scholars. Latin disappeared as the Roman civilization has been crushed under the weight of the barbarian invasions. French, Italians, and Spanish are considered to result from contact between ancient peoples of the Roman Empire and the barbarians. This assertion also implied that modern European peoples had been cut off from their ancient past. However, any possible similarity between the Western Middle Ages and Byzantium could lead to a very specific perception and interpretation of the Greek national history. Admitting that the ancient Greek is a dead language implies an interpretation in full contradiction with the meaning that Greek scholars strived to attribute to the Greek historical evolution. Denying the indivisibility of Greek, as well as its singular character, could dissociate its speakers from their ancestors. This viewpoint could also imply that the ethnic and cultural interbreeding that occurred during the Middle Ages was similar both in Western and Southeastern Europe. This eventually questions the survival of the ancient Greek genius. This is a mindset within which Greek scholars tried to show the opposition between the two situations. That also explains why, throughout the second half of the century, they overstressed the differences between the historical development of modern Greek and that of the Romance languages. Yet, regarding the vernaculars as corrupt and semi-barbaric aggregates, which was the dominant vision until the mid-19th century, might have set serious doubts upon the Hellenic origin of the rural population, living on the edge of a region claimed by both the Bulgarian and Greek irredentism. Such lingering doubts hovering in some European scholar circles before 1853 became, in this new political context, a real danger for Greeks. Falmeraia's theory of Slavic population becoming Greek during the Middle Ages circulated among the community of scholars, then left the field of academic debate after 1853 and became a potential legitimating argument to the political positions of the Bulgarian nationalism. Thus, reconstructing a Hellenic identity of the rural populations became urgent and turned out to be the responsibility of all educated people. During the second half of the century, a new image of Greek vernaculars and their history arose progressively as the dialectal studies increased. This image gradually outplaced the representation of a corrupt Greco-barbarian language. In this context, the political challenge of the history of the vernaculars clearly appeared. Therefore, language became a strategic argument for the national unification process and for the legitimation of the political goals of Greek nationalism. During this period, scholars had to provide clear evidence of the highly ancient origin and of the historical continuity of vernaculars. This is the way modern Greek dialects managed to stand alongside Kathareusa and ended up becoming the sign of unity and unbroken continuity of Greek. This continuity is certainly an undeniable factor for modern linguistics, but throughout the second half of the 19th century, It was built on a field that was first and foremost intended to accommodate the aspirations of Greek national project. Within the context that I have just described, scholars more or less agreed that it was necessary to bring the language back to a more and more archaic model, or at least to compile an amount of both ancient and modern elements. However, no target language was identified through a concrete morphosyntactic and lexical model, and no norm was set. Literary Attic was certainly the most valued form, but it was not the essential end of the reform. Loans from or links with other ancient or Byzantine varieties were no less legitimate. It was widely recognized that no specific style, form, structure, and most importantly, no system should come from the authority of a single person or be imposed by a limited number of scholars, and even less by a high-level political body. A definitive norm should arise gradually from the work of the whole scholar community, free to create or choose the linguistic aspects it wished to promote. The aim was to provide examples of a model language and to produce, at the same time, a metalinguistic discourse on the suggested innovations. In this context, a new norm was to arise naturally through a kind of linguistic laissez-faire. Scholars' attitudes actually corresponded to this state of mind. Such attitudes, which look like a language improvisation based on a more or less good command of ancient Greek, reinforced the heterogeneous aspect of Katharevousa. Therefore, the continuous Katharevousa archaization process goes along with the proliferation of norms, rather than with the prescription activity aimed at spreading a specific norm. This may explain the total absence of purist language grammars until the mid-1880s. In fact, the 1880s are when modern Greek, in its purest form, was first introduced in elementary schools. The teaching of Katharevousa marked the determination of the Greek state to opt for a specific variety of modern Greek and to disseminate it as widely as possible to the largest number of speakers through the educational system. Furthermore, this political initiative suggests that there was no longer a will to set ancient Greek as the target language, but a strong determination to promote a quick standardization of Katharevousa rather than a continuous archaization. Laws introducing the teaching of Katharevousa were, at a symbolic level, an act that made obvious the separation of ancient and modern Greek. This school reform provoked a response from a non-negligible part of Greek scholars and teachers. Introducing Katharevousa in schools was perceived as an attempt to stop the language reform process or as an effort to freeze modern Greek before it looked ancient enough. Furthermore, launching a school grammar could presuppose that one admits the separation of Greek in two languages, an ancient and a modern one, which finally infringes the indivisibility principle. In fact, that Greek language unity principle had for a long time prevented Katharevousa from being considered as a full-fledged language. Any attempt to stop its evolution or to teach it like an independent subject was therefore illegitimate. After all, Katharevousa was a mere auxiliary to ancient Greek, doomed to disappear as it was expected to evolve towards forms closer to ancient Greek. These reasons could also explain the development and the direction of Greek lexicography after 1830. Since the two languages were not supposed to be two different entities, the creation of a real monolingual dictionary of modern Greek, aspiring to provide a lexical norm of Katharevousa, did not meet Greek lexicographers' interest. Lexicographical work, fairly abundant, only dealt with diachronic monolingual dictionaries or synchronic bilingual and bidirectional dictionaries. However, we cannot speak about a real publication project for any reference monolingual dictionary that would be supervised by a major cultural institution. As far as the literate elites were concerned, it was obvious that there was no immediate need for a regulatory authority likely to publish such a piece of work. The foundation decree of the Academy was published in 1836, but its opening was postponed until the beginning of the 20th century. The main goal of the 19th century dictionaries was to save, store, and accumulate in order to produce a lexical wealth of modern Greek. The Greek lexicography put emphasis on the conquest of the fields of communication, on lexical enrichment, neology, translation, archaization, without, however, underlining any normative work. The number of neologisms and their semantic density exponentially increased until the end of the century. Lexical prescription went along with the archaization process. The guiding principle to all scholars' work was to dip into ancient Greek to create new works, new words, and to exclude barbarisms. Ancient Greek dictionaries, quite abundant throughout the period, were the tool for comparing modern with ancient Greek, providing the roots for neologisms and endowing modern Greek lexicon with a strong Hellenic identity. The 19th century Greek lexicography had a unifying and an identity function rather than a purpose to build a functional standard language, a language that would be spread throughout schools and that should be aligned with the practical needs of state, technology, and economy. The postulates of the Greek language founding myths arose in a particular historical context. They were part of the national ideology and became arguments that sustained the idea of unity and continuity in Greek history. At the same time, they were part of an ideological arsenal whose function was to legitimize concrete political demands and positions. Greek, considered as an indivisible language, almost immutable over the centuries, and a singular case in the history of languages, became an identity indicator and acquired a capital role in the realization of the Greek national project. Within this context, the aim of the reform was, in one way or another, to bring ancient Greek back to life. Thus, there was neither a synchronic language target nor a prescribing determination, but a set of principles that provided a framework within which several norms were developed. The absence of a real prescriptive practice and the lack of normative works can be explained by the will to bring the language into a more and more archaic form, whereas disseminating the ancient literature and language in the Balkans became a priority. Within this mindset, the emergence of a norm and the standardization were seen as the result of a natural regulation, a kind of linguistic laissez-faire, effective on the long term. Thank you very much for your attention.